This is Specific Objects, Talks on Art in the Catskills, and I am your host, Miriam Atkin. Today I have here with me in the studio the Catskill-based composer Larry Chernikoff, and I'll start out by sharing his bio. Larry Chernikoff is a self-taught composer and instrumentalist, an award-winning recording artist, a recipient of a National Endowment for the Arts Jazz Fellowship, and a record producer. His compositions combine jazz and classical elements, composition and improvisation, and unusual instrumental colors, often with orchestral instruments such as clarinet, bass clarinet, cello, violin, oboe, English horn, and bassoon, in addition to traditionally jazz instruments such as saxophone and trumpet. He has written for dance, theater, and film. Whenever possible, his ensembles perform with no amplifiers or microphones. Larry has two nights of concerts in Catskill and Pine Plains coming up this weekend. And to get the conversation started, I'd like to jump right in and play some of his new work that will debut at those performances. And this is a piece called Only This Moment. Thank you. If you're just tuning in, this is Specific Objects, Talks on Art in the Catskills. And we've just heard a piece by Catskill-based composer Larry Chernikoff called Only This Moment. Larry, so the first thing I'd like to ask is, what is the instrumentation that we're hearing here?
This is my current ensemble. It's an eight-piece group, and there are three woodwind players, and all of them play clarinet and bass clarinet and all of the saxophones. And then one of the guys, Ben Kono, also plays English horn and oboe. So there's a woodwind section of three. And again, no saxophones. And then there's a low string section with a upright bass and cello. And then piano, percussion, and vibraphone. I'm a vibraphonist, and I go through this all the time. People say to me, oh, you're a musician. What instrument do you play? The vibraphone. What is that? Right? And everybody's seen it and heard it. It's a big xylophone with metal keys, but people aren't as familiar with it as with other instruments. So yeah, it's an octet. Three woodwinds, two strings, piano, vibraphone, and percussion.
When I was in college, I lived in a house with some musicians, one of whom was...
That's always trouble.
Yeah. Well, it was good for me for the time. But yes, one of them was a vibraphonist. So it's a beautiful instrument. And I'm wondering if you could tell me a bit about how this group came together.
Well, I had been on a musical hiatus for a number of years, even before the pandemic, and then since the pandemic, until a year ago when we played in Hudson. We did our first concert in Hudson. During the pandemic, I started envisioning, I don't know if that's the right word, a different sound, sort of moving away from the traditional saxophones that I had always written for, toward the clarinet family and English horn and oboe. It's more of a chamber music or orchestral, softer kind of sound. And I arranged to play in Hudson, and I contacted two old colleagues of mine, two woodwind players, and then I just put the group together. I have been playing for a long time, and this is one of my idiosyncrasies as a so-called jazz musician, that for many years I didn't have a drummer in my band, because again, I'm looking for a different kind of a sound that's more at the crossroads of jazz and chamber music. And I often felt like I would go to see jazz groups and think, why is that guy sitting in the back and flailing away and banging around so much? But then I heard this, I saw a concert at B.D. Powers in Catskill, a couple of concerts, and I saw a percussionist named Brian Mellick, who kind of a local hero in the greater upstate area. He's played with everybody. And he just seemed to me, aside from being a wonderful percussionist, the most joyous percussionist I had ever seen. Like, you can't watch him play without just grinning the whole time because he's so happy.
Yeah.
So I added a percussion to the group. I had met Eugene Free. By the way, I should say right up front that this is the best band that I've ever had in all of these decades. We're all older, seasoned musicians, and these guys are just next level players and improvisers. So the cello player, Eugene Friesen, is a guy I had met. He's been playing with the Paul Winter Consort for 40 years. He's an artist in residence at St. John the Divine in New York. He travels all over the world. He conducts the Berklee College of Music String Orchestra. And then when I was getting ready for that concert last year, a piano player, German jazz artist named Carl Berger, who is a longtime associate of mine, mentor and a teacher. He was going to play piano, as he did on my last CD, but Carl passed away before that could happen. And somebody gave me Chuck Lamb's phone number. Chuck Lamb also is a major, major voice in jazz piano. He replaced Dave Brubeck in Dave Brubeck's band when Dave passed away. I mean, he's just... So, one thing led to another. Somebody introduced me to somebody else, and I ended up with this really just superlative ensemble.
Something that really stands out to me when I listen to this track and some of the other pieces representing your new work is the kind of the way that the individual voices are really articulated and have sound like they have a kind of ownership of the composition in this way. And it's a dialogue that feels very joyful and affectionate, and the personality of each voice is really distinct. And I'm trying to think of the right language to describe this, but you know, I'm hearing that there's a play between composition and improvisation, and yet I feel like the players have a very active creative role throughout.
Yeah, I think that's very, very good observation. I like to try to create the environment where you really don't feel any bump in the road between the composition and the improvisation. Mm. To sand off the rough edges between the end of a composition and the beginning and continuation of improvisation. The other thing that I'm really fascinated by, when I was a young musician, a young jazz musician, I thought Dixieland jazz was terrible, corny and silly. But I came to appreciate the fact that those players are improvising all together at the same time. Hmm. It's not like there's a soloist with accompaniment. They are all just doing their thing together. It's really quite amazing. And in our best moments, that same kind of thing happens. The best moments, we heard some of them just now, are the moments when everybody's just making it up together. But I think your observation is a good one about the individual voices and personalities of the players. If that comes through to you, that's wonderful. You should see them live. I mean, you know, I said earlier that I had been on a musical hiatus for a number of years until last year when we got together. And I had forgotten what a joyous brotherhood and sisterhood, but not this time, the jazz community is. Yeah. And one thing you can say about jazz musicians is they have personality, individual personality. They're real individualists. And it's fun.
Yeah, I mean, that's in a way, that's my definition of jazz, I think, is just this way in which, or this form that allows different voices to converse with each other and compete with each other and be in harmony and be in discord. Yeah. But the voice, you know, regardless of what instrument you're playing, is just, it's very, very personalized.
That's right. Yeah. I think you're right.
Yeah. So you're in the band and you're also the band leader. Mm. I'm interested in hearing a bit about your approach to being a band leader. Mm-hmm. Like, what's that practice like?
That's a deep question. I never studied composition formally. And I've never earned my living exclusively with music. I'm surrounded by other musicians who do. Although, you know, one guy owns a saxophone repair shop. Another guy restores furniture. I mean, the music business is a cruel business, and everybody has to kind of put a life together. And I've done a lot of other things, mostly graphic design work. And because I started writing for my own groups, first a quintet and then a 10-piece group and now an 8-piece group, I had to become a band leader. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my role is to deliver the charts that I write to the musicians and then try to guide the process. But with this particular group, I can give them the barest sketches of things. You know, there'll be a written section and then a sketch of where we're going to go. And they just come up with stuff that I would have never dreamed of as the composer. Mm-hmm. So there have been times as a band leader when I was exerting too much control for recording sessions and stuff, and I wanted everything to be perfect. Now I've decided that it's really quite possible to loosen the reins and just let them do what they do so well. I do not I'm not a band leader who features myself as a player. Mm-hmm. I tend to play to fade into the background a little bit, just because these guys are so amazing. And, you know, my contribution is to write the music and then let them do what they do.
Yeah, as I was listening to the new pieces, I was listening in for the vibraphone parts, and it was very subtle, the presence of the vibraphone, at least in the tracks that I heard.
Yep.
Yeah. I'm very curious about your evolution as a musician, and especially how it culminated in this very unique middle place between composition and improvisation, or chamber music and jazz. Yeah, so if you could talk a little bit about the trajectory that led you here.
I dropped out of college as an architecture student to play in a rock and roll band in the San Francisco Bay Area in the late 1960s, an acid rock band. I was a guitar player at the time, and I moved back to New York, and I had been listening to jazz. When I was a teenager, my brother was a disc jockey, a jazz disc jockey. And so even at a young age, I was listening to the Beatles and the Stones and John Coltrane and all of the, you know, classic jazz. When I moved back to New York, I enrolled in an improvisation class at the New School that was taught by a German jazz vibraphonist and pianist named Carl Berger, who had just taken over that class from John Cage. And one thing led to another. I ended up following Carl and his family and his wife, the singer Ingrid Cerzo, who's still active here in the Hudson Valley, to Germany, and spent quite a bit of time there. And that in the early 70s, it was a heyday, and I'm not sure the heyday ever ended, of free jazz scene in Europe. The European jazz musicians liked to go crazy and make a lot of noise. Mm-hmm. And I got caught up in that and met a lot of people and had some wonderful experiences. But I was in my early 20s, and I didn't know how to read music. So I spent a few semesters at the Berklee College of Music. I learned to read. And I'm actually answering your question, Miriam, in terms of evolution.
Yes.
So I went from rock and roll to free jazz, wild, noisy music. And then I ended up at the Creative Music Studio in Woodstock, which is sort of a legendary institution that's still going on. It has had a number of incarnations. But at the time in the 1970s, it was very unique, and I think maybe the first thing of its kind, a rural retreat for jazz music. And I use the term jazz only descriptively because the people who came to teach were from India and Africa and Latin America and contemporary, quote, serious music and avant-garde jazz and traditional jazz. I mean, it was really quite a cross-pollination. And it was not a teaching school. It was more of a exposure, experiential school. So, for example, people like Anthony Braxton and Dave Holland and Jack mm-hmm. DeJohnette and the Art Ensemble of Chicago used to come in and spend a week rehearsing, and we would do a concert on Saturday night. So there was, I was exposed to a lot of approaches to music, music from around the world, and approaches to musical notation. And it opened up my mind. And so, you know, I spent a lot of years, then I had my own quintet, and I was started to write music, wrote music for dance. I had a group in Woodstock called the Woodstock Music and Dance Ensemble with 7 musicians and 4 dancers, and I was started writing. But at a certain point, I became sort of, I started to question the whole traditional jazz performance format. And I was looking for something more, at least to my mind, more poetic in the music, something with music with more nuance, more delicacy, and sort of a contemplative vibe. Now, yeah. You didn't hear that. We didn't really hear that on the track that you played, but a lot of my current music is quieter. And again, when I was younger and through the years, I tried to come up with music that was hip, with a certain jazz attitude. But now, when I think about sharing my music with an audience, what I hope to do is for about an hour or an hour and a quarter for us to live in a certain sound space that is healthy. It is uplifting. When I listen to music now, what I hear first and foremost is its intention. Is this music trying to get me to buy more stuff when I'm in the store? Is this music trying to get me to dance? Is it trying to break my heart? My intention is to try to give people what I think of as sort of organic health food music.
Yeah.
That's my aim. And that's why we play without amplifiers and microphones, except there is a caveat, and that is that sometimes in a particular performance situation, we do need to make the cello and the bass a little louder to compete with a 3 horns and a vibraphone and a piano. So we need to boost their sound a little bit, but it's very minimal. So yeah, organic health food music.
Yeah, something that I really like about that story is that you found yourself in this really intellectually, creatively fruitful environment at the Creative Music Studio in Woodstock, and it was so expansive and open as far as the people that you were exposed to and the traditions that you were exposed to, that it actually sort of led you, the openness actually led you in a completely different direction that was like specifically your own.
Well, I like to think that where I've ended up is specifically my own, but in reality, I am a part of a generation of musicians. And in fact, everybody, you know, we're in this situation now where we can listen to music from anywhere in the world, from down through the ages, in our earbuds on the subway, anytime we want. I mean, it's all there at our fingertips all the time. And for musicians, that has resulted in a kind of aesthetic where musicians don't know boundaries or genres. We don't care stylistically anymore. I mean, Bella Fleck, the banjo player, recorded in Africa. I mean, it's just one big wide world of music now. So you flatter me, and yeah, I think I'm finding my own voice, but so's everybody around me. All the musicians are, you know, it's like everybody's got their own soup with their own ingredients that they can take off any shelf and just create their musical soup.
Yeah, right. And, you know, the people who were raised with this kind of access don't, I find, like, the younger people in my life don't necessarily have a sense of the era from which different traditions or songs or bands emerged. It's just all, it's all now.
Right. Well, it is. Yeah. I mean, it is. It's true. It's all here. To talk about how I ended up here and my musical influences, which you asked about, during the 1970s and 80s, a German record label called ECM Records came to prominence. Mm-hmm. And it was a European label. And there was a co-mingling of American jazz musicians who've always found a welcome home in Europe and European jazz musicians. And jazz had taken root in Europe long ago, many decades ago. And the ECM record label came up with something very quite new. Improvised music by composer improvisers, but not necessarily rooted in the what we think of as the American roots tradition. Hmm. Tin Pan Alley, the songbook, the Great American Songbook, the blues, New Orleans jazz, they come from some other place where what's informing their so-called jazz music or improvised music is 3,000-year-old Scandinavian folk traditions or the folk traditions of Italy. So EC, you know, at a certain point, I realized that because during my formative years, I was listening to so much music on the ECM record label, that's really my roots. Mm-hmm. That's what I consider my genre.
And in talking about, you arrived at this sort of new vision for your music during the pandemic, and my sense is that you were on a slightly, it was a divergence, you were on a slightly different trajectory beforehand. And I think that it might be interesting to listen to something else just to be exposed to the difference.
Sure, that would be great. I think there's a composition on my CD from a number of years ago that exemplifies pretty well an antecedent of the kind of thing that I'm doing now.
Great, yeah.
And this is a group, it's a 10-piece group with French horn, bassoon, clarinet, violin, cello, piano, vibraphone, bass, I mean, chamber jazz. It's a large chamber jazz ensemble.
Okay, so here we have Talking Rain from the album titled October. Thank you. If you're just tuning in, this is Specific Objects, Talks on Art in the Catskills. I'm your host, Miriam Atkin. And here in the studio with me is Catskill-based composer Larry Chernikoff. And we've just heard track number 3 from his 2004 album, October. And the track is called Talking Rain. This is quite different from the piece that we heard at the top of the show. And maybe again, I'll ask you about the instrumentation of this piece.
Mm. Well, it starts with an introduction of a vibraphone and harp. And then the harp plays throughout the piece, this kind of a long sequence over and over again. There's a bass solo and a vibraphone solo. And in the background, there is a French horn, bassoon, violin, cello, and clarinet. It's really, again, a kind of a large chamber ensemble. But I think we could agree that it has a kind of a improvisational jazz vibe.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and I'm noticing the titles of the tracks on this album are all somewhat elemental. Hmm. You have Wind Horse and Light Years, Talking Rain. Again, the album is called October. And it reminds me of a conversation that I had with you at a barbecue in the Catskills. And we were talking, or I learned about your longstanding interest in clouds. And yeah, it was just this really interesting conversation about the unique, or the cloud formations that are unique to this region. And so I'm wondering if your interest in clouds and windy skies is somehow informing the shape or the sound of this piece. And, or maybe informing your thinking about composition during this period?
Good question. It's not by design that the elements have ended up in my titles. It just happens.
Hmm.
And it's really timely question because right now I have two compositions, which I believe we're going to play tomorrow night. Friday, October 25th, at the First Reformed Church in Catskill. And one of them is called A Window Facing West, which is, I haven't even finished writing it yet, but I only have like 5 days to go before and it's just named after the window in my room where I face out and see the Catskills in the distance. And there's another composition that I'm working on right now, which is sort of an experimental kind of thing that's called Cumulus. Now, I think maybe the conversation that you were referring to that we had at the barbecue, I was probably pointing out, as I do to people way too frequently, that right here in the Mid-Hudson Valley, as is true in almost all of North America, most of the time, we are experiencing prevailing westerly winds. The weather moves generally from west to east. And here in the Hudson Valley, the westerly winds rise up over the Catskill Mountains and cool as they rise up and precipitate clouds.
Mm.
One of the things that I didn't know when I moved to the Hudson Valley 7 years ago was just how beautiful the skies are here on an almost daily basis, if you tune into it. So to answer your question, I have two new compositions that we're probably going to play next week. One called A Window Facing West, which is where I see those clouds, and another piece called Cumulus, which is a kind of an attempt at portraying those puffy clouds that we see all the time here.
Yeah. And just to clarify, because we're recording this ahead of time, When you are hearing this, it will be just one day before the Catskill concert. So it won't be next week. It'll be tomorrow.
Right.
So,
thank you.
And it's donation based, right? Is that right?
Yes. There is a $10 donation at the door. And it's in...
no advance tickets?
No advance tickets. Okay. It's in the First Reformed Church, big brick church that's a couple of doors down from the Catskill Post Office. And I looked on Google Maps and discovered that the First Reformed Church is 350 yards from my house, which is a little unusual for me to walk to the gig.
I guess one thing I wanted to ask you about the two concerts that are coming up is, I know you mentioned that you started off studying architecture and your compositions are generally meant to be unamplified. So I'm wondering, like, do you have a specific opinion of or response to these two spaces, how they work acoustically or sonically, or do you have what's your relationship to these spaces?
Well, the First Reformed Church is an old church right in Catskill, very close to my house, right on Main Street, and it's a big church. And, you know, I've always liked playing music in houses of worship, whatever kind of house of worship they might have been. There is, you know, that sort of austere and uplifted feeling that you have when you walk into a house of worship. And because I've never played there before, so I don't really know what the acoustics are going to be like. But we'll make it work, I'm sure. And then the Saturday night, the day after, night after tomorrow, we're going to be playing not too far from here in a little town called Pine Plains, which is right off the Taconic, somewhere south of Rhinebeck. And there's this converted or renovated old community building right in the heart of this little tiny town called the Stissing Center. The first time I went to the Stissing Center, I heard a concert by the Bard College Percussion Ensemble. And I walked into this room in this renovated old building, and I just fell in love with the room. It's a kind of a square room. It's been renovated, and it's all wood. And it's just an absolutely beautiful room with great acoustics. So I'm very excited about playing there, too. It's a wonderful space and worth the drive.
And for that concert, do people need to get advance tickets?
They are suggested, and you can get them online at the Stissing Center, STISSING, thestissingcenter.org, on their events page, and you can buy tickets online.
That will be a nice little day trip for people. I think the town of Pine Plains is very charming. And there's this little bookstore that's in a house with multiple floors. I don't know if they're always open. Seems like the kind of place that's just open when they're open. But yeah, you can make a day of it.
Yeah, and there are also a couple of world-class restaurants in that little town. But, you know, you might have needed to make reservations 2 months ago. I don't know. Google it.
Yeah, so since this show is about local and regional art making, I always like to ask people about their history and creative connection with the Hudson Valley and the Catskills. And we talked already about your time in Woodstock, which sounds like it was very
fertile.
Yes. And I guess I wanted to know a little bit more about that. Like, did you feel like the creative music studio was actively connected with Woodstock and what other art and music was being produced in that time and in that place? Or did it feel significant that it was in Woodstock, in the Catskills?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think by the time the Creative Music Studio arrived in 1971 in Woodstock from New York City, Bob Dylan and the band had already been living there. You know, Janis Joplin had already passed through, and Van Morrison, and Woodstock was already on the map musically. The Creative Music Studio, and there have been several books written about it, attracted other musicians. You know, big name jazz people started moving to Woodstock. And there was a lot of cross-pollination, dance, art, poetry. A lot of things happened at the Creative Music Studio. And of course, Woodstock is Woodstock. Mm-hmm. And Woodstock has not changed a lot since the 1970s, except that it looks like most of the people there are older now. But, you know, I love Woodstock. It's like no place else. It's in a hippie time warp. And, you know, it's wonderful that it's still there. And, you know, it was a way of life. And people came to the Creative Music Studio, young musicians from all over the world. You know, we would be playing concerts and there would be a team of Japanese journalists and video. You know, it was really quite a wonderful scene. And, you know, there are people in the Hudson Valley and in Woodstock in particular who will tell you that the pyramid shapes of the mountains in Overlook Mountain in particular, just above Woodstock, you know, that those pyramids are energy sources. You know, the Hudson Valley is, you know, I moved away. I lived in Woodstock for about 5 years, and then I lived in the Berkshires in Massachusetts for a long time. My wife and I met here in the Hudson Valley. We were both working at an arts organization in Rhinebeck called the Open Studio, which was founded by George Quasha and George and Susan Quasha. And so my wife, Billy, and I met there, and then we lived away for tens of years. But 7 years ago, we moved back and still feel at home here. I spent so long living in New England that part of me is like very New England. But there's something that I like about the wild and funky charm of the Catskills that they don't have. You know, New England is tidier.
Yes.
And Catskills are rougher.
Yeah.
How would you describe it? You know what I'm talking about.
Well, there is a shift, some different feeling, you know, once you are far enough east to cross over into Massachusetts. Totally. The architecture is different.
The vegetation is different. Yeah. The topography of the land is different.
Yeah.
And it was settled by the English, where here we have this darker kind of Dutch vibe. Yeah, I became convinced long ago that the state boundaries in the United States are where they are for reasons. And I think that the Massachusetts-New York boundary is very clear to see the cultural, delta.
Yeah, it really is. So we're approaching the end of our time here, and I'm wondering if we can close by listening to one last piece of music. And what would you like to close with?
Well, I love all my children, some more than others, though. I think I'd like to close with a recent piece called True Home, which again, like something we listened to earlier, is composed and then improvised by everybody all together. And because these players are such marvels, I just like the direction that they took it in.
So now we're going to listen to True Home, a new piece by Larry Chernikov and the Higher Octave Ensemble. Thank you. Before we go, I want to ask you where people can find further details about your shows this weekend.
Good question. You would find the BD Powers Place website, which may be bdpowers.org. I'm just not sure offhand. BD Powers is presenting our concert at the First Reformed Church in Catskill because our group is too big to play at BD Powers, which is a lovely, lovely place to go and hear music up at the top of Bridge Street in Catskill. So I think it's bdpowers.org. And then to get more information about our concert at the Stissing Center in Pine Plains, again, it's thestissingcenter.org.
Well, Larry Chernikoff, thanks so much for talking to me. It's been a real thrill.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.